I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news now for 30 years in two languages all over the world. Here in the United States, interviewed four presidents, worked at four or five different television networks. And I believe, after all of that, that news should be direct and impactful. And this is Direct Impact. So here's what I want to start with. When the moment finally arrived at the BRICS summit, right, announcing that it would admit Iran and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Argentina, Ethiopia and the United Arab Emirates, few around the world were really surprised, at least not in the astute geopolitical realm.
We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates.
You see, for most of the world, this is no longer news because it was expected. Do you know what the real news is going to be? I'm going to tell you. The real news is going to be what happens next, as there's already talk of the future of BRICS, a BRICS that could incorporate 20, 30, some people are even saying some 40 countries into their future summits. Now ask yourself, who would have imagined that nowadays there would be so many countries competing for an invitation to the BRICS meeting? Think about that. An organization that began when Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa joined forces to try and balance Western dominance. And now some believe that in the not so distant future, right, BRICS could be as powerful or maybe even more so than the G7 or NATO even. What is most interesting is that while all of this is going on, and the world is recognizing BRICS and sees it as an essential group, in the United States, they hardly even know what it is. Here in America, most people don't even know anything about BRICS. It's as if it doesn't even exist. Most Americans have never even heard of BRICS. And if they have heard of BRICS, they probably think it's a factory somewhere that makes concrete blocks or something. It's like, it may be, by the way, that because of that, I don't know what else to call it, but ignorance on our part, BRICS could someday compete or even surpass the rest of the world when it comes to the global economy and perhaps even the military realm. You see, it's argued that as the West sleeps through this, BRICS will continue to expand into a more powerful force, advancing in technology, as we see with India, for example, and in artificial intelligence, where it's clear that we in the United States have a lot to catch up to with China, for example, where in China right now, as we speak, there are 8- and 9-year-olds that are already learning how to program computers using AI.
Набирает силу объективный, необратимый процесс дедоларизации наших хозяйственных связей. Предпринимаются усилия по отработке эффективных механизмов взаимных расчетов и валютно-финансового контроля. Как результат, доля доллара в экспортно-импортных операциях в рамках БРИКС снижается. В прошлом году она составила всего лишь 28,7%.
The point at which BRICS could cause the most damage to the United States, though, is when it comes to currency. And there's no doubt that that day is nearing, right? In fact, the movement toward a BRICS currency has gained even more momentum and more speed in the last 12 months. Why? Well, let me take you through this. A lot of people are saying and believe it's because of the war in Ukraine. How are they connected? Well, here. You see, even before the war, there were a lot of countries all over the world that had already concluded that Western countries, especially the United States, were just using economic warlike tactics against them.
I'm talking about the West sanction fever. It's brazen and aggressive attempts to force others on how to behave, deprive them of their sovereignty, and force them into submission. There is nothing unusual about that. This policy has been used by the West for decades.
There's little doubt that our politicians' message of superiority and of almost, at least the way it's taken as belittling, and or sanctioning any country that disagrees with them has manifested itself in, as really the true origin of BRICS, right? La raison, the reason. But in the case of Ukraine, it reached an unprecedented level. Why? There are three types of reactions from countries all over the world to the situation in Ukraine, right? And let me take you through those. There are those who blame Russia and say they're at fault. There are those who believe NATO and the United States are responsible for provoking the situation and making it happen. And then there are those who just, you know, don't care. They're neither on one side or the other. But when the United States froze Russia's assets and accounts and imposed sanctions on their exports and tried to deny a lot of countries their right to establish or maintain relations with Russia, the opposite of what the United States expected actually happened. So, feeling the economic threat and thinking that, hey, if they can do it to Russia, maybe they can do it to us too, a lot of countries, including China, India, and many of the African nations, they grew closer to Russia, not farther away during the crisis. And at the same time, they're also growing closer to BRICS. And joining us now, all the way from Johannesburg, is Kofi Kuwaku. He is an analyst who specializes in both Africa and China. To say that those are two hot zones would be an understatement. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
I am really surprised, I must admit, by the popularity of BRICS. It's almost like the countries see it as scoring a World Cup ticket or a ticket to the Super Bowl. Why does suddenly everybody want in?
Well, Rick, this is really simple. You have the status quo, and then you have something that's hot, like chili, salsa. You know, everybody's looking at finding a different way to taste the new world, which many people call an emerging world. And what it is it's sort of the opposite of what's called a non-Western world. And that excites people at two powerful drivers. First is the geopolitics, and second is the geoeconomics.
Interesting. You're in Africa, so I want to start with Africa. Let's talk about Africa. Let's talk about why it is that suddenly Africa seems to be more interested in aligning itself with non-Western unions. Why?
I mean, Africans have had so much trouble with the former colonizers, mainly the West Anglo-Saxon world, which has really, you know, kept it under its boot for so many centuries, and sort of snapping it, sucking it out, sucking everything that's possible, especially resources, natural resources. And Africans are not getting anything out of it. If you've been following what's going on in Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and Central African Republic, Africa is about natural resources. And there is a sort of an emerging what's called resource nationalism. People are now saying, hey, our resources must benefit us first before benefiting anybody else. And everybody is feeling that.
But if countries in Africa, and by the way, in Latin America and other places that have all also been under the boot, as you say, to steal your words, feel that way, one can't help but wonder if they still shouldn't go with the best available suitor. And if that suitor happens to be, you know, the UK or the United States, and the United States and UK come clean and say, I know we did horrible things in your country and in your continent in the past, but, you know, let's just let bygones be bygones and let's look toward the future. Could they still muster some kind of appeal if they did that? Or is the problem that they don't do that?
Well, they're not doing it. And one of the things that's exciting is, in fact, Africa is having a contrarian word of looking at what's called, dealing with the devil you know than the one you don't know. And they're saying, we're taking a different way. We're going to try an alternative route to find something else. We want different choices. We want to experiment them. Let that experiment them. Let us try something new. Alternative partnership with Russia, China, any other countries that are showing up, even Turkey. And I think that's what, it's not just it's exciting, but the ability to have that agency, that choice to try something new, it's really raising up the hope of Africans.
And when you say try something new, you mean don't look necessarily toward the West, right? Look to India, look to China, look to Iran, look to Saudi Arabia, look to Russia, look to these countries who in the past have not been the bell of the ball.
That's right. And we would hope, African would hope that something will be different there, as the Chinese call it, win-win. You know, but we're also very cautious. We said, hey, it's going to be a win-win, but wait a minute, when these people become so powerful, we may not have that. We may have the same old stuff that coming from the Anglo-Saxon, but still, let's try it.
Yeah. That's not to say that China's not going to lend you a lot of money and then at the end squeeze you with interest rates that you can't handle, just like Western countries have done to a lot of developing countries as well. But we'll leave that for the future. Let me ask you this. I'm wondering, I've been watching how BRICS has become unbelievably attractive to most countries, especially like within the last year and a half. And it just so happens that in that same year and a half, we've been watching what's going on in Ukraine, where the United States has really, to use your term again, put the boot on Russia. I mean, done things that, you know, from an economic standpoint, almost seem warlike. I can't help but want. And by the way, countries in Africa and around the world have aligned themselves with Russia, some argue, because of that. So I'm also wondering then if those same countries who've aligned themselves with Russia because they've seen the victimization or what they've perceived as the victimization of Russia on the part of the West are also now saying, you know what? And to boot, we're going to join BRICS.
Yes, indeed. In fact, the Ukraine crisis have taught a lot, especially the reaction to the Ukraine crisis from the G7 have sent a shiver into people's spine and said, my goodness, if we're dealing with these people, they're going to grab our money. They call it freezing assets, but we all know it's the stolen assets, you know, freezing more than $380 billion of Russian money. The Chinese are watching. They're also under sanction. And in other groups, Iran, and, you know, the list goes on and on. They say, well, do we have a choice here? What kind of different choices and opportunities we're going to have? And that being said, we've seen that the BRICS meeting, the BRICS summit, because it brings people of an eclectic nature, you don't have to bow to a sort of monolithic or one hegemonic unilateral person or group or country. They said, we have an opportunity, we have a choice to look at it. And the BRICS summit has overshadowed the crisis in Ukraine. Even getting back now, people are struggling to figure out, because the BRICS summit was so powerful, both the narrative and the new countries are coming in. People are, they're struggling to even describe with the old analysis, what kind of countries are these? They don't get together, nothing really clicks right. That is the challenge of tomorrow.
You know, there's another example on the horizon that I can think of. And being from Latin America, as you know, I've always looked at the world through the perception of what has happened historically in Latin America. And there's been a lot of horrible things that have happened in Latin America, as you know, in Colombia and in Panama and Santo Domingo and,
Chile.
Even more recently, some of the things that have happened in Venezuela.
Yeah.
You know, love or dislike Chavez and Venezuela, and we can have arguments about whether it's a good government or they made mistakes. One thing is for sure, when the United States goes in there and freezes Venezuela's assets in the UK, no less, and then shuts down their main corporation, Citgo, you can't help but ask yourself, even if you hate Venezuela, do we have the right to do this to somebody?
That's right. That's right. And that kind of pain is felt across the globe now. And today it's easier. So you have shows like yours that are now sending out the narrative, the truth about what's happening around the world. And people are now buying to it. The media, in fact, has been one of the most important driving forces in the image, the new image of the BRICS. And I have yet to see a show that really looks at the BRICS and the media, global media, and how it's been reported. And we've seen, for example, that Western media, mainstream media, haven't. I mean, I've been watching The Economist, The Financial Times. The past 2 weeks, I'm buying them. Say, where is the cover?
Thank you, Kofi. Don't go away. I have more questions for you. So, by the way, I want to continue this conversation with you as well, because we can have this conversation on Twitter, where you can reach me at Rick Sanchez TV. That's Rick Sanchez TV. Okay, when we come back. So what is the U.S. media saying about BRICS, in particular, CNN? You know, it's always fun to check and see what my old colleagues over there are up to. Stay right there. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, it's always interesting to see how CNN, where I used to work, tries to inform Americans about global issues. Though I got to tell you, I was a little surprised when I saw this headline that seemed to give China some credit for the expansion of BRICS. I mean, here's the headline right here. I'll read it to you. BRICS expansion is a big win for China, says CNN. But then, at the same time, they ask in the same sentence, will China, but can it really work as a counterweight to the West? So implying they don't think that China is going to have the ability to muster the right competition against the United States. It's fascinating. And we're joined once again by Kofi Kuwaku. He is a special analyst on China and Africa, who knows all things BRICS, has attended, and is very familiar with the organization. He's joining us from Johannesburg. You mentioned something about the unique position that Israel lately finds itself in. I venture to think that what they're doing is playing both sides of the fence. Is that what you were referring to, or what do you think their role is in
yes,
all of this?
I mean, I must say, I've been doing some research and touching base. I mean, I can't give you my sources, but Israel has been doing an incredible balancing exercise to try to figure out how they work both with the United States and then with China. And they've done a tremendous job, especially under Netanyahu, who's visited China already, red carpet there. And they've given tons of business to the Chinese. The Chinese are managing, I think, two ports out there in Israel. I think the port of Haifa and in another one, I forgot the name. And not only that, also doing business directly with tech companies in China and tech companies also in Israel. And this kind of very quiet opportunity that's really under the radar hasn't been talked about much by many people. In fact, one of the ambassadors of China was found dead in his office when he arrived about a week or a month, and there were some kind of speculation, but we didn't know what happened. But in any case, what is important is Israel quietly is developing some relationship with China, and you know the relationship, very old relationship between the Jews of Israel and then, of course, China. There are Jews in China, an unbelievable story to know. I think it's still developing.
How big can BRICS get? Do you think, I mean, you've heard, you've probably read the same stories that I've been reading lately. Some people are saying it's going to go to 20, maybe go to 30, could even go to 40. Who are we talking about? I mean, I imagine more countries in Latin America and more countries in Africa. What else? Middle East?
Yes, I think, Eastern well, as Pacific you said, Rim? I agree with you, more countries in Africa, because Africa, the Chinese have made it clear, is their future as well. The French say the same thing, but the Chinese are a little bit more serious. They have a 50-year plan, and they're looking at 2049, as you know, the key date, the time horizon, where the I think the Communist Party becomes somewhere around 100 years or something of that sort. But in any case, what is important, the BRICS going to grow. Already, it's around, according to the numbers I have, $56 trillion, I mean, in GDP. That's huge. I mean, it goes beyond the 14 to 15 trillion of the United States, and they're going to keep growing. However, I just said to somebody that multilateralism is not for sissies, right? Because the road to multilateralism is going to be rocky, rough, and tough. Some of them, in fact, I can see the BRICS potentially in the long run split into small groups. And this is the kind of world we're going to have. They're going to be big for a while if they organize their membership right, and they have the right criteria to help them get together and focus on what really matters. At this stage, it seems like they're against the G7, but they need to refine it a little bit more.
To what end, though? To what end is BRICS? And my guess, I don't want to lead you, but I'm thinking at first, if nothing else, it has to all be about currency. It has to be about what I hear coming out of BRICS and what I hear coming out of other groups around the world, which is the concern for the dollar and a push toward de-dollarization. Is that the ultimate goal?
It's going to be one of them, but that's a very small part of it, especially at this stage. It's not just being against the U.S. dollar that's going to count for the future of the BRICS. One of a couple of things. The first one is the idea, but also the ideal of multilateralism, mm-hmm. having polycenters of power. People have agency, but an important thing is monetary sovereignty. When people can decide on their own sovereignty using that money, that currency that they want. People have been using the term local currency. I feel uncomfortable using the term local. I like the term national currencies. It makes more, it's more reflective. And so that's the one thing. But sovereignty in general, economic security, of course, monetary sovereignty.
Let me try and put an attitude on what you're saying. I think what I hear you saying is, if I were a country, Rick Sanchez is a country, Rick Sanchez doesn't think that someone has a right to come and tell me who I can trade with, who I can do business with, where I can put my money or where I can't put my money. And that has been, if not the fear, the reality of what's been going on. Is that pretty much what you're saying?
That's the big deal of it. I mean, Rick, all of us have studied economics. So we look at market, a relationship between country A and country B to trade. We want to trade in our money. It doesn't make sense to trade with a third party money. I mean, clearly, and the world has been under this since, 1972 or 71, since the Nixon thing, you know. But people are now saying, wait a minute, why have we been, I mean, the president of Brazil, Lula, has asked this question at the summit here in South Africa. So why are we trading with the American dollar? It was a tough question.
Interestingly enough, this is a fascinating conversation. I love where you're going with this. So does South Africa have its own currency? And it uses it for its purposes? Does, you know, Namibia have its own? Does UK? Does Lula da Silva have the same in Brazil? Or, as I heard Lula da Silva say when I last heard him speak at his assembly of Latin American leaders, they're thinking about having a Latin American currency. And an African currency, and an Eastern Pacific Rim currency, et cetera, et cetera. Regional currencies. Would that work?
Well, it might work, but it's a bit complicated because what they're looking at is a basket of currencies. So that when they have this basket of currencies, people can trade in those currencies. They don't have to worry about the U.S. dollar with the feds consistently, you know, Treasury raising up interest rate and making it difficult for everybody. They say that's one of the reasons they use the term local, but I'm more comfortable with national. So if we trade in our own monies, we don't have to get the wrath of somebody else and giving us a hard time. Sanctions, you know, complicated deals. The U.S. has more than 20,000 sanctions against countries around the world. This is insane. And it doesn't help the U.S. It's killing global trade. And one of the two elements that are really important with this BRICS is to say, we want to do global trade with less restriction and less sanctions. And the second one is, we want to keep our sovereignty so that nobody tells us how to behave.
Thanks, Kofi. That really was a fascinating conversation. You're really good at this. So, all right, before we go, I want to remind you of something. It's a mission for us, and it's really pretty simple. We want to de-silo the world. You know, I mean, everybody's in their separate camps. We've got to stop living in these little boxes. I mean, the truths don't live in boxes. Truth is everywhere. That's how we see it. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide some direct impact.